Hey there, this is Laura Kanoy.
Shh.
What? I mean, what?
Loretta Allison here. We're having a secret drive.
Oh, so that means...
Shh.
Oh, got it. If you love the exchange, consider a small donation to the station that makes it.
Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in, and we'll send you some secret swag.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope you'll make some noise for the exchange.
This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It may be hard to imagine today, but certain vitamins have changed human destiny by preventing and curing diseases, such as vitamin C for scurvy or vitamin A for blindness. But in this country, pretty quickly, these micronutrients took on a life of their own, about a century after they were discovered, in the hands of food marketers who made all kinds of promises about vitamins' benefits, from having more energy to altering disagreeable aspects of your personality. Vitamins' popularity soared in the 1930s and 40s, to the point where one journalist declared America was in the midst of what he called Vitamania. And a few decades later, that enthusiasm for vitamins spawned a much larger nutritional supplement industry, which today boasts more than $30 billion in sales each year. All of this, according to a new book by our guest today, Catherine Price, has altered the way we think about food, the way we eat. And Price makes the case, it's not for the better. Today in The Exchange, Vitamania. We talk with author Catherine Price, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Catherine Price joins us from Philadelphia. And Catherine, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's turn to that example that almost everybody knows, scurvy. I remember being told when I was a kid, you know, eat your fruits and vegetables or you'll get scurvy. How did scurvy lead to the discovery of what we now call vitamins?
Scurvy is the deficiency disease of vitamin C, and I think that is the one that most of us tend to know about from grade school. For some reason, it's like always covered in units about explorers, I feel like. So, yes, it's a deficiency in vitamin C. It is an interesting case because scurvy really couldn't occur without the development of technology for people to stay out at sea for a long time. So basically, in the age of exploration, when people started to like take long voyages and didn't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, scurvy started popping up. And that's something that you see a lot in these nutritional deficiency diseases, is that there's some kind of advance that man makes in one area, and then it causes problems elsewhere. But basically, there was a problem where over a million sailors died of scurvy. It was a really serious disease where you started to feel very lethargic. You started to have, you know, easy bruising. All sorts of horrible things started happening to your body, and eventually you would die. And the reason was that you need vitamin C in order to make collagen, which is a protein in the body that really holds us together. And so even though I feel like scurvy is almost laughable these days to us, but in reality, like if you have scurvy, your body starts to come apart from within. It's an absolutely horrible disease. And it was a total mystery because at that time, you know, there wasn't very much understood about disease to begin with. Germs hadn't even been discovered at that point. So in retrospect, we tend to think that, oh, scurvy, that's what led to the discovery of the vitamins. But in reality, it didn't really. No one identified a vitamin until the 20th century. What scurvy did do, though, is it provided an example of one of the first controlled experiments. There was a Scottish physician named James Lind who was on a voyage, and he took a group of sailors with scurvy, and he divided them into several groups. and gave them different treatments, some of which were, to our minds, totally random and ineffective, like salt water.
Wait, he gave sailors salt water?
Yeah, you'd think, he did. It didn't work. But he also gave a group of them lemons. They had some, you know, a few lemons on board. Those sailors got better so quickly that they actually were able to help care for the other sailors,
Wow. Even
though they didn't have enough lemons to make it for the whole 14-day course of the experiment. So a lot of us credit James Lynn for actually discovering that citrus fruit cures scurvy. But in fact, he himself didn't really conclude that. He wrote several versions of this really long book on the scurvy, as he called it. And the lemon juice line was tucked into like one sentence because there were a lot of other confounding variables. And it just, you know, this was such a weird thing. Why would you think this horrible disease would be cured by lemon juice? But in
retrospect,
this was
an example. Doesn't seem dramatic enough, does it?
Yeah, right? Lemonade. Like, you really wouldn't think it. Another interesting thing is that when this connection was made conceptually, even though people didn't know why it was happening, the British Navy started using limes because they controlled a lot of colonies that grew limes instead of lemons. And those don't have as much vitamin C in them, interestingly. So it still worked, but you needed more. But that is the reason that British sailors are sometimes called limeys.
Well, and you're right. It's pretty dramatic, Catherine, that, you know, scurvy, they had no idea what caused it, although it seems so obvious to us today. Some ship captains, you write, just assumed a certain percentage of the crew, a large percentage of the crew, would die. It was just the way it was. It's pretty terrible.
Yeah, they basically, you know, they had like an overage of crew members and just thought, okay, well, we're going to lose some of them, or a lot of them, frankly.
So,
it was very bad.
How long between that discovery of limes or lemons or whatever, between that discovery and the broader discovery that, hey, there's some magical compound in this food that can really have dramatic effects? You write, Catherine, that this was kind of a shift in the whole way that people thought about illness and cure.
Yes. So when we tend to think of like discoveries of things, we think of a particular moment. But the discovery of vitamins was definitely not a moment. It was stretched out over at least 50, if not 100 years. So basically, several things happened. In the 1870s, you started to see this incidence of this disease called beriberi in Southeast Asia in particular. We now know that's a thiamine deficiency disease, and it was caused, or in those cases, mainly by another technological advance, which was the ability to remove the husks from rice and create what was known as polished rice, which basically is white rice. And the husk of the rice is what contains the vitamins. So by taking that off and then giving people diets very heavy in white rice, they cause nutritional deficiencies. Now, beriberi is another example of a disease that you would never think would be prevented or cured by eating a bowl of rice. It is a horrible disease that causes paralysis and convulsions, and, you know, it kills you also. So it took a very long time for that to be recognized as a deficiency. Part of the reason was, as I was alluding to before, is that germ theory began to evolve or emerge around the same time that beriberi emerged, germ theory being the discovery and idea that bacteria and germs are behind many of the most terrible diseases out there. So researchers or people who were trying to look into and discover the cause of beriberi were looking for a germ. Like, it took a very long time to recognize that you could have a disease that was caused by something that's not there versus something that is there. So that took a very long time. And basically, it's really a confusing area of science because there are 13 vitamins, and each of them causes different symptoms if you've got deficiencies. So it took a while for all of these threads to be put together. And I would say that it was really around, I mean, the word was coined in 1911. That was before any of them were really chemically isolated. And I'd say that they did gain scientific acceptance between like 1905 and 1920. But even as late as the 30s, people did not believe that pellagra, which is a niacin deficiency disease, was being caused by a nutritional deficiency. They still thought it was being caused by a germ. So that's a long way of answering your question to say that it really is, it's a long process of discovery.
Well,
and
but
it required several, you know, theoretical shifts in how we think about disease.
That's right. It caused sort of a major mind shift that this was not caused by some outside factor, but actually an internal deficiency, sometimes based on, as you said, you know, an emerging lifestyle change that on the face of it would seem for the better, right? Hey, you can go exploring now. This is great. But then you're leaving behind your source of fresh fruits and vegetables and coming down with this terrible, terrible disease. So before we go too much further into the, just how once these vitamins were discovered, Catherine, and how they just very quickly took off into this vitamania, the title of your book. Just remind us, what is a vitamin, you know, versus a mineral or a compound or a supplement? What's a vitamin at its most fundamental form?
Well, I answer that in several ways. The most important thing from like a day-to-day standpoint is we use the word vitamin interchangeably with dietary supplement a lot of the times. If you go into your drugstore and you look at the aisle where all the supplements are, it'll often say vitamins as the, you know, title of the aisle or whatever. But there's actually only 13 human vitamins, and there are upwards of 85,000 dietary supplement products on the market. So dietary supplements include not just vitamins, but minerals, amino acids, herbal products, botanical products, bodybuilding powders, all sorts of other stuff that we can get into later, like why those are all lumped together. But vitamins are different. Vitamins are substances made by living organisms that we humans need in some level in order to avoid deficiency diseases. So they're associated with particular deficiency diseases. One of the strangest things about vitamins, though, is that there's actually no concrete chemical definition of what a vitamin is, because the word was created before they were discovered. And in fact, many of the early scientists thought that the word was going to fall out of use because it didn't really describe, they're not a cohesive family. They're very different. So I think that that's fascinating, because vitamin really was just such a good marketing term that we still use it more than 100 years later,
Despite
the fact that the people who were studying them thought, no, this is kind of a stupid term because it doesn't mean anything.
Well, vitality, you know, so there's a connection there. So it is a good marketing term. What did they want to call it?
Oh, well, they had other ideas, food hormone or fat-soluble A, water-soluble B, accessory factor. And if you think about those names, I think it really reflects the power of the word vitamin, because I really don't think you would have like Flintstones accessory factors that all of us felt compelled to give our children every day.
So what does a vitamin look like? I mean, you know, your average B-complex pill, for example, it's round and it's not that big, and maybe it's yellow or orange, but what is the actual B5 or B6 or B12? What does that look like?
Well, I went to a place where they actually make, you know, new vitamin products, and I had a very dorky experience where they were showing me vials of pure vitamins, and I just thought this was so cool. Like, vitamin E is this thick, viscous, clear fluid that doesn't taste like anything. Thiamine is very bitter. It's a white powder. Vitamin B12 is pink. So I found that, I don't know why, like, the idea of actually seeing a vitamin to me was just so cool. And that same company, DSM, actually also gave me these slides of like magnified vitamins. So for a long time, and they're very pretty because they put pretty, you know, light. So like vitamin K is this beautiful flower-like thing. And for a long time, I had vitamin K as the lock screen on my phone. Then I had a baby, so now she's the lock screen, but vitamin K for quite a while.
How tiny are the amounts that we're talking about that most of us supposedly need?
Well, really, really, really tiny. That's what's kind of crazy to me, is like if you actually look at how small these amounts are, it's almost inconceivable. So like, for example, if folic acid, for example, is a vitamin that prevents neural tube defects in developing fetuses, which basically is the baby's nervous system and spinal cord. It's a really devastating defect. So the amount of folic acid you actually need to prevent that is about 240 micrograms a day. And as I did this math, it's actually less than the weight of 2 grains of salt, of Morton salt.
That's amazing.
Right, which is crazy. And the other one that I thought, I mean, even crazier is B12, right, the pink one. So it can cause everything from depression and memory loss and delusions, all sorts of bad things, life-threatening anemia. And you only need 2.4 micrograms, which is basically 1/67th of a grain of salt per day.
So huge benefits, and you really need just a tiny, tiny amount.
Yeah, it's almost inconceivably small amounts. And that also was part of the reason they were so hard to discover, because they, you know, it's really hard to measure something that small or that light. And they also burn if you combust food, which is something that early nutritionists did. So if you burn food, you'll be left with the minerals because they don't burn, but the vitamins do. So you're not going to know that they ever were there.
Wow. So don't overcook your food or you lose the vitamins?
Well, I guess that's the same. I'm talking about when they actually like burned it to a powder.
I see. Okay.
Yes. Yes, no, not like you left your greens on the stove for too long. But, I mean, there are vitamins that are sensitive to heat. So, yeah, if we get into the whole, like, which ones are sensitive to heat, which ones are sensitive to light, like, basically, there's a vitamin that's sensitive to everything. C is particularly sensitive. But I tell people not to obsess about that too much. Like, if you're eating lots of foods that naturally contain a lot of vitamins, then I don't think you really need to worry about if you're cooking them or freezing them or eating them raw.
Well, Catherine, I want to invite our listeners to join us, and then I have a ton more questions for you, especially about the history of this Vitamania and how it really took off and all the claims that were made. You can join us as well, 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with author Catherine Price. Her book is Vitamania, How Vitamins Revolutionize the Way We Think About Food. If you have questions, comments, thoughts about how vitamins are marketed to us today, what some of the messages are, what some of the vitamins are that you take, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, Catherine, you sketched out, you know, how vitamins were discovered and how they were understood as beneficial and, you know, deficiencies causing some really serious problems. So Vitamania takes off in the 20s and 30s. What were some of the products and messages that we saw way back then, Catherine, about vitamins and all the great things that they could do for us?
Well, it was really kind of amazing to me to see how quickly vitamins leapt from the scientist's world to the food marketer's world. And one person in particular really helped do that. It was a scientist named Elmer McCollum, who was one of the primary people who discovered vitamin A and D, and he did a lot of work with early vitamins. But he also wrote a column for McCall's magazine that was geared towards housewives, basically. And it was so interesting from a journalist perspective because you could see he was running out of topics. Like, he wrote this column for almost 20 years. And it's really hard. It's really hard to find new topics about nutrition to write about every month for 20 years. Like, you can see that in newspapers and magazines today. Like, how many articles about blueberries can we possibly have? But anyway, point being that Elmer McCollum raised consumers' awareness that there were these things in foods that were invisible and tasteless, but absolutely essential for health, and that if you didn't have enough of them, bad things would happen to you, and that you, as a housewife in particular, would be harming your family and doing them a huge disservice if you didn't give them the foods that contained vitamins. So he wasn't, at that point, really pushing any particular manufactured product, but the food manufacturers, and food manufacturing really kind of took off around the same time as well, started to realize, ooh, this is a really great marketing thing for our foods because we can't measure how much is in the food. I mean, it's very imprecise. We don't know how much people need. We just know they're essential, and then people are now scared of deficiencies. So you start seeing things like cod liver oil being advertised as a way to give your baby a well-shaped head. There was a breakfast cereal called Vitamin Rain, and I have a funny advertisement that I got from McCall's, actually, that says that basically, I think it's a picture of a woman with her family, and it says, like, you feel guilty if you don't give your family Vitamin Rain each day.
Vitamin Rain?
Vitamin Rain. Yeah, that one has not made it through the
Was it a drink or a cereal?
No, it was a cereal, and they talked about raining down. It was like a vitamin spray. I mean, cereals get their vitamins often from being sprayed with them, but this version referred to that as rain.
And there then were there's drinks another one.
Yeah, there were drinks. There were thiamine spiked like peanut butter and chocolate and chewing gum. I love an ad that I found for canned pineapple that claimed that you should start or end at least one meal a day with canned pineapple, and then talked about how the processing of the pineapple gave you more vitamins, which, to go back to your question, that's not true.
Yeah.
It actually destroys the vitamin C. But again, at that point, you couldn't tell. So it just was like a wonderful marketing term. And, you know, companies realized if you put vitamins in your products, people are going to want to buy them because they're both hopeful it'll do something great, and they're fearful of what might happen if they don't get them.
Well, and it's almost funny, some of the you know, the stuff that McCollum wrote and that others wrote, really pressuring women, you know, poor nutrition. If you didn't give your kids enough vitamins, they could have quote unquote unfortunate personality traits, you know, yes. Self-pity, lack of confidence. So if you didn't buy this Vitamin Rain cereal and give it to your kids, then they might turn out to be, you know, selfish.
Right. And, you know, you might think that would be just limited to food marketers. But in fact, in World War II, vitamins became a huge concern of the government. There was actually a conference about nutrition for the national defense. And in particular, they were worried about thiamine, which we can talk more about.
Sure, absolutely. Vitamins and the role that they were put into supposedly preparing American soldiers for the war effort, comparing our guys to the Germans and how well vitamined they were. We'll definitely talk about that and start taking your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Catherine Price, author of the new book, Vitamania, How Vitamins Revolutionized the Way We Think About Food. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. What are some of the messages that you hear about vitamins? What are some of the questions you have about the way vitamins and the supplement industry that they spawned are marketed to us today? 1-800-892-6477. And Catherine, before we go to our listeners, just before the break, we were talking about how vitamins were actually made part of the war effort by the U.S. government leading up to World War II. What were some of the stories that you uncovered there?
Yeah, I just found that fascinating because I didn't realize how high up vitamins got as a source of concern. In World War I, calories were a big issue. There was a lot of worry about whether or not American soldiers would have enough to eat and enough energy. But in World War II, it was really about vitamins. So I read through the whole transcript of this conference, and, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt was one of the speakers. But basically, they were concerned that American soldiers and American people in general would not have enough vitamins and that it might affect, among other things, our morale. And they particularly were interested in thiamine because it was thought of as the oomph vitamin. That's O-O-M-P-H. And it was supposed to give you pep and energy and increase your morale. And so that actually was World War II was when a lot of these thiamine-spiked products in particular hit the American marketplace. And I found that very interesting because I thought it was a good example of something that, in retrospect, seems kind of absurd. I mean, do you really think that you could get more oomph by eating bread that's enriched with thiamine? But then you look at some of the things we believe today, like emergency for colds or some of the vitamin water stuff that recently got shut down. And it's really just as crazy. It's
so we've always had these vitamin claims. Was there any validity to those concerns, though, about, you know, here's America just emerging from a depression. Many people were very poor. Maybe they did have poor nutrition. Maybe they did need some B vitamins. I don't know. Was there anything to base that on?
Well, I mean, up to the 30s, as I was mentioning, pellagra, which is the niacin deficiency, which is a B vitamin, that really was a problem in the American South. So that definitely needed to be addressed. That was basically because there was a lot of, like, corn-based diets and people were not eating a diversity of foods. By World War II, there weren't that many frank, outright nutritional deficiency diseases like scurvy, things like that, affecting Americans. But I do think that as food manufacturing progressed and as more and more people were eating manufactured foods, we did have an issue with vitamins because when you manufacture foods or when you process them to have long shelf lives, which is necessary if you want to ship them around the country, you have to remove the parts of the foods that have the vitamins because in the case of flour, for example, the most vitamin-rich part is also the part that will make it go rancid quicker. So if we don't have enrichment, which means putting vitamins back in, then you would have problems. Around the 30s and 40s, that's when it really became possible to put synthetic vitamins back into foods, and that's why we began this long tradition of enriching flour. So to answer your question, it wasn't a huge outright, like, horrible problem in America. If we hadn't started adding synthetic vitamins back to our foods, though, I don't think that we would have been able to get to the point where we are today, where we eat so many of these processed foods that have had their natural vitamins removed.
Yeah, and that's a huge central point in the book, Catherine, and I definitely want to ask you more about that. This drive for convenience and easy, long shelf life processed foods, stripping the vitamins out, and then we add them back in. That's a big issue that you write about. But let's go to our listeners and talk to James. He's calling in from Randolph. Hi, James. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a couple of questions. One, I'm in my 70s, and I stopped taking multiple vitamins, let's say the first part of this year, because I became concerned of the chemicals that may be added to them that may be harmful. I guess the thing is synthetic vitamins versus natural vitamins. And is that a problem? And number two, to purchase them? Should you purchase them from health stores versus pharmacies or super Walmarts? Is there a difference?
You know, these are great questions, James. And to the first one, Catherine, I do hear a lot these days about synthetic vitamins versus vitamins advertised anyway as from being derived from whole food and so forth. Is there really a difference, or is it more a pretty label versus a boring label?
Well, I mean, in terms of natural and synthetic, well, first of all, those are great questions, James. I'm glad you raised them, and there's a lot to say to each of them. But to just address them briefly, synthetic versus natural vitamins, I don't think you should get too caught up in that just because there are circumstances where the synthetic form is easier for our bodies to absorb than the quote-unquote natural one, and vice versa. So two specific examples that might be useful to know about would be folic acid, which is the synthetic form of folate, is actually easier to absorb. And the same goes for vitamin B12. And when you're over 50 or 60, you actually it becomes harder to absorb B12 through your food because it requires a lot of different steps in your body. So in cases of people over 50, synthetic B12 can be a better choice. The question about how to choose a good vitamin is a really good one that we can get into in more detail later. But basically, because of the way vitamins are regulated in the United States, it's very difficult to tell which ones contain what they say they do. I think the bigger issue with dietary supplements in general is you can have some crazy stuff added to it, and we can get to that later. In terms of vitamins, what I'd recommend is that you look for verification from a third-party company that's actually doing tests to make sure that the vitamin contains what it says on the label. And my favorite sources for those are there's two seals you can look for. One is USP certified. The other one is NSF, USP certified and NSF. And those are companies that supplement makers can contract to test their products for them. If you're a big supplement taker, I recommend signing up for a subscription to ConsumerLab.com. Consumer Lab is an independent company that pulls vitamins and supplements off of store shelves and then tests them to make sure that they contain what they say they do. And the benefit of that, from your perspective, James, is that they will do it by store brand. So you can actually look and see, okay, like Walgreens brand was approved by Consumer Lab. It did contain what it said, and it is this number of cents per pill versus, you know, a dollar or whatever for this other company. So you can do like both a quality and a price comparison. Although I do emphasize that those companies aren't checking for safety or efficacy. They're just checking to make sure the product contains what it says, but those are useful tools to have.
So even though natural food-based vitamins may sound better than synthetic vitamins, you're saying it's not really that different, Catherine? Is that right?
Well, it depends on a case-by-case basis. So in general, I just think that we'd be better served by taking a broader picture of what we're eating rather than obsessing over the minutiae, you know. So I think that in general, I think it's better to eat foods that naturally contain a lot of vitamins, mostly because those foods also contain other stuff that are not vitamins that we don't know that much about. And all of those components may have synergistic effects with each other that we don't know about and can't really replicate. And so in my mind, it's better to kind of embrace that uncertainty and just eat, say, an orange instead of taking a vitamin C tablet, because I don't know what else is in the orange or what it's doing, but I'm going to guess that it's maybe doing something good for me, and I don't know what it is. Does that make sense? Or it has fiber?
It does make
other
sense.
Stuff.
Yeah, all these other compounds, and some we know, some we don't even know. But you're just repeating the advice that we're hearing so much more these days, Catherine, which is get your vitamins when you can from food, because there's other stuff in there that is also beneficial, even if we haven't pinpointed it yet.
Yeah, I think what's slightly new to my mind is that message to me has been really been made through the idea that food, like specifying the compounds, oh, red wine has resveratrol, or like tomatoes have lycopene, that's why you should eat them in food. And I'm really saying, like, I don't really know what lycopene does. No one knows what lycopene does. But does that really matter? We know it's there. We know there's other stuff in that tomato. I probably should just eat the tomato.
Well, thank you for the call. And let's go next to Kristen in Nashua. Hi, Kristen. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. My comment is, a couple of years ago, I went through a weight loss program that really heavily promoted their own brand of supplements because they claimed that modern day produce was such a monoculture and had been so, you know, it was weak and it didn't contain the right amount of vitamins anymore, and that you couldn't get enough without taking supplements. And given that you need such trace amounts, I find that kind of hard to believe. And it struck me at the time as kind of a marketing ploy. What do you think?
You know, Kristen, this is a great question. Thank you for calling. I have heard this too, Catherine. Some people concerned that the way our food is sort of quickly and mass-produced, that it's not as vitamin-rich as, you know, it was when our grandparents or our great-grandparents ate it, that today's cantaloupe doesn't have the same vitamin compound or as robust a vitamin profile as perhaps it did 50 years ago. Is that true, or is that a marketing ploy, as Kristen asks?
Well, I think in the case of the program Kristen's talking about with the supplements and the weight loss program, that's a marketing ploy. They want you to buy their supplements. The broader question of whether or not there have been changes in our crops over the past, I don't know, 100 years or so, I mean, that's a different question, and it's interesting. Again, it depends on what angle you're coming from. I mean, one thing I find interesting is that, again, in order to have produce that was shelf-stable and able to be shipped across the country or across the world, you had to breed specific characteristics into the plants, right? So like tomatoes that, I mean, everyone complains about supermarket tomatoes because they have this thick skin, they don't really taste like much. And that is partially because mostly because the tomatoes were bred to have thick skin, and taste and nutrition was not actually really part of the equation. Does that mean that you should just forget about supermarket tomatoes and take those supplements from the weight loss program? I would say no, but I guess technically it might have less. There are actual issues with some of the minerals because the plants make their own vitamins, but they pull minerals out of the soil. And so there are situations where in certain places in the world, like much of Europe actually, certain minerals are less common in the soil, and so you actually can have difficulty getting them into the crops. So there's a lot of nuances, but I think what I would say in general is that if someone tells you, oh, well, you should take our supplement because your peach isn't as good as it used to be, don't listen to them. And I don't know. I mean, if you look at it relatively, eating the peach is going to be better than eating a cracker or eating peach-flavored water that has vitamin C in it. So I think it's all relative.
Kristen, it's a great question. Thank you for calling in. And so this is the key point in your book, and we've touched on it, but let's dig in a little bit more, Catherine. This Vitamania, supposedly aimed at health, you say has in a way made us less healthy. So just connect the dots for us there, please.
Yeah, I thought that was so interesting. So I kind of alluded to this beforehand, but at some point in my research, I kind of realized that, oh, wow, we actually could not be eating the way that we are eating today if we didn't have synthetic vitamins. Because as I was saying, in order to make products that are able to, sit in a gas station for 2 years before someone buys them. Have you ever picked up a package of something and there's actually dust on it and you're like, how is this still edible? I mean, that's because it was very highly processed and anything that would have made it go bad has been taken out. And that, as I said, often includes the vitamins, or it's been put under high heat, which destroys them, et cetera, right? So if you look at our food from that perspective, you're like, oh my God, all these things, like, we just couldn't eat this way. We would have to eat differently if we didn't have synthetic vitamins. And I think that vitamins give us a free pass to eat all sorts of foods that if we really thought about it, we would know are not healthy. Like breakfast cereal. I mean, it is crazy the claims you can see on breakfast cereals. Some of the most sugary breakfast cereals will say great source of vitamin D, right? And you're like, really? Are we really going to buy the Cocoa Puffs for our kids and tell ourselves we're doing a good thing because it has vitamin D? So I think if we buy into this idea that anything that contains vitamins is good for us, we lose the much bigger picture message that those vitamins, if they were put in to replace what had been there, that food is probably not that healthy.
Right, because that's the point you made earlier. This ultra-processed foods, actually the processing strips the original vitamins out, and then they have to be added back in. But who knows what else you're missing from that food. And plus, as you say, you get filled up on the processed stuff and then there's no room left over for the tomato or the cantaloupe or whatever.
Right. And a lot of people will say, oh, should I take a multivitamin? And I always say to that question, well, you have to ask yourself what you're eating, right? I mean, if you're eating like the cover of a Michael Pollan book, then you're probably fine on vitamins. You're probably good on fiber. You're probably getting all sorts of other stuff. Like, that's great. If you're eating such a poor diet, like saltine crackers, you know, for like that's all you're eating. Or I actually have heard of people who have only eaten ice cream for a year. Okay, you probably need a multivitamin. You probably also should eat differently, but in the meantime, take a multivitamin. But there's this broad swath in the middle of people who are eating a lot of these processed foods that have had their vitamins put back into them. And for those people, I say, all right, the question of whether to take a multivitamin is actually kind of the wrong question, because you already are taking a multivitamin by eating the synthetic vitamins in your food. In fact, you may be getting more vitamins than people who are eating the Michael Pollan diet, because so much, the levels of vitamins added to foods could be quite high if you eat a bunch of those fortified foods. So the question there is, okay, I'm taking my multivitamin, but what else am I missing? And I also like to say, like, people will say, oh, it's kind of an insurance policy. I'm just taking the multivitamin in case. And what occurred to me while I was doing my research is that's kind of like taking the wrong kind of insurance policy out. You know, you're taking out an insurance policy for floods, but you're actually living in an area that's at risk of earthquakes. So you're insuring the wrong thing.
Because everything's so fortified?
Yeah, because if you're eating a lot of those fortified and enriched products, you're fine on vitamins. You're great on vitamins, but maybe you're not good on fiber. Maybe you're not getting all these other unknown compounds.
Well, wow. Lots to think about. I want to go back to our listeners, and then I have another big question for you, Catherine, about how vitamins spawn this much, much larger supplement industry. But let's go back to the phones. And again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're looking at the history of vitamins and supplements in this country through a new book called Vitamania. The author is Catherine Price. She joins us from Philadelphia. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. And Chris is calling in from Troy. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Chris. Go ahead. Yep, go ahead.
My question may have already been answered, but I was wondering about the lack of vitamins in some of the canned foods. But, you know, on the other hand, on the flip side of that, some of the supplements that I take have enormous amounts of vitamins, like 12,000% of vitamin B12, for instance. What happens when you have that kind of excessive amount?
You know, that is a great question. Sort of mega-dose vitamins, that if B12 is important for certain body metabolism and functions and so forth, then maybe mega doses are really, really good for your body. What do you think, Catherine? What about these mega doses that Chris asks about?
Well, I think that's a really great question to ask also, Chris, because people tend not to ask that question, and they should. And I think that the most accurate answer is that we don't know. We don't know what those mega doses are going to do over time. And that, to me, is concerning. People like to say that in the case of water-soluble vitamins in particular, such as C or B12, actually all of the Bs, that they just wash out in your urine, and so, oh, it's fine if you take too much or more than you need because you'll just excrete it. There are lots of jokes about Americans having the most expensive urine in the world. But to me, that doesn't really convince me that it's safe necessarily over the long term to do that. And the analogy I like to use is that of a plant. So if you've got a plant, obviously you need to water it, right? You could give it just the right amount of water, but you also could totally saturate its soil, and then the water would come out the bottom of the pot. And you'd say, oh, well, okay, well, it's being excreted. I mean, it must be fine. But in reality, that excess water that's in the soil could be doing stuff like rotting the roots, for example. I mean, it could have effects that are not good for the plant, even though the excess is being excreted through the holes in the bottom of the pot, if that makes sense. So in general, I just don't think it's a good idea to assume that taking thousands of times the recommended dietary allowance of a vitamin is a good idea. And in the case of some of the fat-soluble vitamins, like A in particular, it's definitely not a good idea.
Yeah, that we know. Fat-soluble vitamins like A, E, D, and K. Am I right on that,
You are.
Catherine?
Well done.
Don't overdose on those, because they do store themselves in your fat. There's some questions, though, you're saying, even about the ones that are water-soluble that we like to say we just flush out, but you're saying maybe yes, maybe no. We will talk more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Catherine Price, author of a new book called Vitamania, How Vitamins Revolutionize the Way We Think About Food. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. What questions do you have about the vitamins and supplements all around us in our food and the promises made about these compounds? 1-800-892-6477 again is our number, 1-800-892-NHPR. So, Catherine, you talk about vitamins, obviously, a lot, the history and so forth. But then you go into a much bigger subject area, and that's supplements. You write that supplements have, quote, clung to the coattails of vitamins. First of all, just remind us again what a supplement is, how it's different from a vitamin, and then we'll talk about the history of these products.
Okay, so there's 13 human vitamins, meaning substances we need in small amounts, normally from food, to prevent a particular nutritional deficiency disease. Dietary supplements, on the other hand, is a much broader category. There's something about around, actually more than 85,000 different supplement products on the market. That includes vitamins, minerals, amino acids, herbal products, weight loss supplements, sexual enhancement supplements, bodybuilding powders, these things called organs and glandulars, which I'm like, really? Are people, they're ground up glands and organs? So anyway, it's a huge category. But they are regulated exactly the same way.
Which means not at all.
No, they are. So the supplement industry will be very, very, very quick to point out that actually they are regulated. There are rules for the FDA and that the FDA has to follow in terms of how to regulate these products. But that regulation is very, very, very different from how most of us would maybe think it is or should be.
Well, and let's get into that, because that is a big chunk of this book. You write that some of these supplements have a less than stellar history. For example, L-tryptophan. What's the story with that substance?
Well, L-tryptophan, people were taking for sleep, and basically there was this strange illness that started to occur in the 90s that was eventually linked to L-tryptophan, although they didn't exactly find the precise cause, but it basically, in some people, ruined their lives. One woman in particular was paralyzed and couldn't walk, like had shooting pains in her body. She testified before Congress, actually, about this, saying we really need to have more stringent regulations. But basically, I mean, the issue is that the dietary supplement industry recognized the appeal of the word vitamin, which, as you were saying, it has vita, the Latin word for life. It just, vitamins just seem safe, right, because they're in food. Who's going to say that you could overdose on oranges or regulate that you need to control people's access to an orange? And the dietary supplement industry realized that if they wanted to get laws passed that were beneficial to their industry, it would behoove them to use the words vitamins and dietary supplements interchangeably, which if you think about it is really kind of amazing that they succeeded, because the only similarity between these substances is that you can buy them as pills, right? Like they're just very different. But the supplement industry launched an enormous public campaign encouraging consumers to write to their congresspeople and to tell them, quote, not to take their vitamins away, and basically accuse the FDA of trying to regulate supplements and vitamins like drugs, which the FDA was not trying to do. There was a very funny, I mean, to my mind, advertisement featuring Mel Gibson, which I encourage all listeners to Google, in which there's basically like a SWAT team that descends upon his Hollywood home, really scary music, and then it cuts to Mel Gibson in his kitchen wearing a brown bathrobe with a thing of vitamin C in his hands. And he's like, vitamin C, guys, like in oranges? And then it's like, boom, and it's like, don't let Congress take your vitamins away. Boom,
wow.
You know, right here. So this was very successful. Millions of letters were sent to Congress. And the result of this is probably the most important law in the history of dietary supplements, which is the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. And that is the act that permanently, or I mean, at least currently still, forbids the FDA from requiring that any dietary supplement be tested for safety or effectiveness before it is put on the market.
So the FDA can't test,
yeah,
you know, whatever, the ginkgo biloba, the St. John's wort, the curcumin, whatever you see, the FDA can't test that for safety and efficacy.
No, they can't require manufacturers to test it. So the best way to understand this is, I guess, is to use the example of the pharmaceutical industry. I'm going to say straight off, I'm not suggesting vitamins should be regulated like pharmaceutical drugs. That's another big thing the industry likes to do, is say, oh, you're suggesting this should be like pharmaceutical drugs. That's not necessarily the case. But in the case of a drug, right, that you're taking for an illness, you have to go through many rounds of tests. You have to start in animal models, work your way up to humans in a small group, a bigger group of humans. The process can take over 10 years. I mean, it actually often does take about a dozen years to get a drug approved, and billions with a B of dollars of research and development. It is a huge investment for companies to develop a new drug in the United States. And as part of that, you need to prove that it does what it says it does and that it is safe enough to make its benefits outweigh the risk. Does that mean there's no problems with that? No, there's problems. There's issues with drugs having long-term side effects that weren't picked up in those trials. That happens all the time. But there's a very stringent process in place to make sure that we do our best to prevent that from happening. Dietary supplements, on the other hand, you don't have to do that for. You and I basically could come up with some concoction and put it in a bottle and start selling it on the internet. We are supposed to have on hand something that suggests that it's safe and effective. But when The Economist, for example, did a story about dietary supplements about a year ago, they mentioned that some of these references were like a Wikipedia entry or a college essay about this particular substance. They don't have to be rigorous science. But the FDA isn't proactively asking people for that justification in most cases, because the FDA doesn't have enough staff to go investigate every single supplement that's on the market. There's just too many. Making it even more difficult is that there's no registry of all the supplement products in the United States. So about 10 years ago, it was the first time that companies were required to register themselves with the FDA, but which itself is crazy. Like before that, there was no list of manufacturers at all, but you still don't have to list your products. And what's more, like self-registration is an active process that kind of, like, not everyone would do it. If you're really sketchy, are you really going to register yourself with the FDA? Probably not. Anyway, I find that kind of terrifying, because it means that if you did have an issue, say, like with the L-tryptophan thing, where a particular dietary supplement ingredient was causing problems, there's no way to send out a mass recall of all the supplements that contain that ingredient, because there isn't a database that says that.
If someone is interested in exploring the benefits, if they've heard about the benefits from some of these supplements, and there are so many, and, you know, oftentimes you do hear about people where conventional medicine has failed them. The regular doctors say, you know, I'm sorry, you're uncomfortable, but I can't help you. What's a safe way to explore the benefits and try and find out if some of these, you know, ancient herbal remedies could actually be helpful?
First of all, I would say to recognize that, like, in ancient times, I think people really would have liked the modern medicine. So it's so funny to me that it's like, ah, yes, in ancient Tibet. And it's like, I've been to Tibet, and I'm actually really grateful that I live in the United States. I have type 1 diabetes, and I went to a clinic there just to see what they would say. And they gave me some, like, weird packets of powder, and I'm really grateful that I have artificial insulin. So putting that aside, I would suggest looking at some of the sites I recommended. The Consumer Lab site has a lot of information about the research that's been done on supplements. For a non-paid alternative, NIH has a pretty good one about herbs in particular. I also would strongly recommend that you don't lie to your doctor about what supplements you're taking. In fact, proactively tell them.
Because there are some interactions, right, with supplements and drugs.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people kind of seem to fail to put together the fact that if you're taking a dietary supplement to make yourself feel better, you're taking that dietary supplement as a form of a drug, whether or not it's called a drug, right? Like, you're taking it because you think it's going to do something. So people tend to think best case scenario, it helps. Worst case scenario, it doesn't do anything. But that is just a silly way of thinking about it. If you look at any other example of any substance we can put in our body, like if you drink too much water, it will kill you. So if it is doing something in your body, it means it could be doing something bad in your body. Or it could be helping, but also interacting with another substance that you're taking or eating. So one of the best examples of this is St. John's wort, which is a very, very popular supplement for depression. Now, it happens to involve the same pathway in your liver in terms of how it's broken down as more than 50% of prescription drugs on the market. What that means is that if you are taking St. John's wort and you're also taking some of these other drugs, those drugs may not act as effectively as they would were you not taking the St. John's wort? And there's some really important examples of that, including antidepressants, which is kind of funny given that most people take St. John's wort for depression, birth control medication. So there's cases where people get pregnant and they're like, but I was taking birth control. Well, you were also taking St. John's wort. Or perhaps even more alarming, organ transplant drugs. There have been cases where people have had their transplanted organ rejected because the St. John's wort interfered with the absorption of the anti-rejection drugs.
So there are some interactions that people need to at least inform themselves about.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, doctors are probably going to say that don't take supplements. Most consumers will then say, I'm going to take them anyway and just not tell you. And I think that both of those approaches are not good because you need to reach a middle ground where you're communicating with one another. But I think we all need to recognize that if we're taking something to do something, then we're taking it as a medicine. It's not a nutritional product.
Let's go back to our listeners, Catherine. And Tara's calling from Henniker. Hi, Tara. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering about vitamin D deficiency. There's been so much discussion about in New England with our very short days during the winter, what have you, that a lot of New Englanders are vitamin D deficient. It seems like doctors are talking a lot about that recently, too.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about your thoughts.
Tara, thank you so much. Vitamin D deficiency. Some doctors, she's right, Catherine, here in northern New England do advise patients to take vitamin D, at least in the winter, because the days are short and a lot of us don't get nearly enough sunlight.
Yeah, I love talking about vitamin D. I'm really happy you brought that up. Vitamin D is a weird vitamin. Remember I was saying there's no definition of a vitamin. Vitamin D acts as a hormone, and we actually likely were not meant to get it from our food because there's actually very few foods that naturally contain a lot of vitamin D. And the best one is probably fish liver oil, which I don't know. I don't think that many Americans
not on
really
a daily
like
basis
that.
Anyway. Yeah,
exactly. Right. And it's hard to camouflage. So we really were more likely meant to get it from the sun because when UVB radiation hits our skin, it starts a process that enables us to make vitamin D. So I think that's a really important point to keep in mind. That the milk, like the D in your milk, is an artificial addition. Nothing wrong with it, but just like we probably were meant to get it from sun. So to me, vitamin D kind of speaks to the whole message of my book, which is kind of grappling with uncertainty and trying to make an educated decision about what to do while still acknowledging that uncertainty. Vitamin D definitely is essential for bone health. We need it to absorb calcium, among other minerals. That's for sure. And the recommended dietary allowances take bone health into account. It may also play a role in a wide range of other conditions. There's vitamin D receptors on nearly every cell of our bodies. It's probably doing other stuff. We don't know what those things are yet, so don't believe claims that it's been proven to cure cancer or, I mean, whatever else like people or newspapers will say. With that said, it probably is doing more than just bone health. My takeaway from that is that if you live in a northern latitude, as your listeners do, basically north of the line that connects San Francisco and Philadelphia and Beijing, then you're probably not going to be able to make enough D, especially in the winter, just by exposing your skin to sunlight because the angle of the sun is such that it doesn't let you get enough radiation. So, and also, sunblock prevents the creation of D, as does clothing. So my takeaway from that is, okay, we don't know all the D does. We actually don't know what the cutoff for deficiency should be. So when you get a blood test, like you don't really know what that means. But to me, it's likely that I'm not getting enough, even if I don't know what enough is. So I personally do take a vitamin D supplement, and I feel good about that because I feel like I'm not taking a crazy amount, right? I'm not doing thousands of times the RDA, but I'm also hedging my bets. And I think that vitamin D is very trendy right now, so it is getting a lot of attention. It's easy to write off as just a trend. I do think that there is going to be more found out about D that does show that we are not getting enough because of this sunlight connection. If you put that all together, my personal conclusion for me was to take a supplement. But I think that's a personal decision or maybe one that you should speak about with your doctor. Does that answer your question? I feel like that was
yeah,
a long
Yeah, no, it is interesting. And you're right. People are talking about it a lot lately in terms of energy and bone health and so forth. And speaking of bone health, here's an email that came in from Anne who says, what about calcium supplements? I don't take them, but most of my middle-aged women friends do. My doctor and what I've read says they are not needed, don't help prevent bone fractures, and in fact can cause kidney stones. Wow. Anne, thank you. I'm not expecting you to be, you know, again, you're not a naturopath or an MD, Catherine, but what have you heard about calcium supplements? She's right. A lot of middle-aged women are advised to take them.
Well, calcium is a mineral, so I'll say straight off the bat that I did not really research the minerals. But I will say that you can get a lot of calcium from your diet if you're eating yogurt or dairy products. And that, why not just do it that way? I also will say that I think that's a good example, actually, of how if you take a lot of a substance over time, you don't know where it's going to end up. Because it is true that if you have too much calcium, also too much D, because you need D to absorb calcium. But if you have too much of that over time, you can end up with deposits of calcium in places you don't want it. But I really can't speak to the calcium supplements in particular, because that's not something that I've researched.
Yeah, okay, well, fair enough. And then there are a fair number of people who are lactose intolerant or who are vegan and don't like to,
right,
to consume animal products.
And that's an important point, too, that, again, if you're asking a question of should you take a multivitamin or should you take a particular vitamin supplement, you have to ask yourself, what are your eating habits? I forgot to mention that before. If you're deliberately not eating animal products, you're a vegan, right? You won't be getting B12 from your diet because B12 is only produced in animal products. So if you're vegan, you should take a B12 supplement. But that's because you've chosen to eliminate that category of foods from your diet.
What do you hope, Catherine, that this book helps people figure out? I mean, I'm so struck by all the uncertainty out there and all that we don't know. What do you hope that this helps people figure out when they're trying to decide whether to, you know, plunk down the $25 and buy the vitamins or not?
I think I really hope that people recognize how much uncertainty there is surrounding nutrition, not just vitamins, but nutrition overall. And then when you recognize that uncertainty, you'll be better able to see through the hype of marketing claims. So if any product is claiming to do something for you because of its vitamins or minerals or phytochemicals or whatever else, there's probably not that much science to back it up. And then to use that to make an educated decision, basically to stress out a bit less. Like it's okay if things are uncertain. We act on what we do know, which is that foods that naturally contain vitamins contain a lot of other good stuff, too. So if we focus our diets on those, we're probably covering our bases.
Yeah, that's the other main message that I got from this book is, fine vitamins, but turn to the food because it's got all sorts of great stuff in it, in addition to the B complex or whatever. Catherine,
yes,
thank you
exactly.
So much. I really appreciate you joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, and thanks to the listeners. Those were great questions.
That's Catherine Price. She's a health journalist and author with work appearing in the New York Times and other publications. Her most recent book that we talked about is Vitamania, How Vitamins Revolutionize the Way We Think About Food. Remember, our conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. It's last call for bills at the State House on issues from police body cameras to mandatory minimum sentences to short-term rentals like Airbnb. And with bipartisan fanfare, New Hampshire launches the first statewide initiative of a national campaign called Change Direction, promoting more open discussion of mental illness. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.